Today is August 4th, 2014. My name is Kelsey Bobel, Research Assistant and Master's Student at IUPUI. Today I have the privilege to be interviewing Ms. Elizabeth Johnson in a conference room in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus. This interview is part of a larger oral history project titled Voices from Indianapolis Waterways. The purpose of this project is to better understand the changing role of waterways, such as the White River, Pleasant Run, Fall Creek, Pogues Run, and Eagle Creek in Indianapolis. Excerpts of some of these interviews may also be used as part of a public art installation by Mary Miss, a New York-based artist. Principal investigators for this project are Philip Scarpino, Director of Public History at IUPUI, and Jason Kelly, Director of IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute. Funding comes from the IUPUI Chancellor's Office, the Arts and Humanities Institute, and the Public History Program. We are interviewing Ms. Johnson because she is a resident of a neighborhood near Pleasant Run and because she is the Education Outreach Coordinator for CEACE at IUPUI. CEACE stands for Center for Earth and Environmental Science. It was established by the Department of Earth Sciences in 1997 and is sponsored within IUPUI by the IUPUI Department of Earth Sciences and the School of Science. It applies environmental research and outreach programs that focus on central Indiana. Programs are meant to be discovery-based to make science real and relevant, and CEACE strives to serve the public through restoration and environmental stewardship. More information on Pleasant Run is recorded on Marty Lamar's interview and can be heard there. Ms. Johnson, I would like to ask your permission to do the following. Record this interview, deposit the interview in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives and the Arts and Humanities Institute for the use of their patrons, including possible posting of this interview or parts of this interview on their website. And use parts of the recording in the public art project carried out by Mary Miss concerning Indianapolis waterways. Do we have your permission to do these things?
Yes, you do.
Wonderful, let's get started. So we're gonna start with a few easy questions. When were you born and where?
I was born in 1985 in Indianapolis.
And then where did you grow up?
I grew up on the north side of Indianapolis. Hamilton County, but Indianapolis address, so about 101st and Meridian.
Before you moved to your current neighborhood near Pleasant Run, did you live anywhere else?
Yes. I lived in Decatur Township. I moved out of state and lived in South Carolina and Louisiana. And then I lived in the Mooresville, in the town of Mooresville, and then surrounding countryside of Mooresville for a while. Before back to Indianapolis.
I'd like to take a couple minutes just to establish some context for those who will listen to this interview later. So when did you move to your present neighborhood?
About a year and a half ago. So November of 2013.
Where is your current neighborhood?
My current neighborhood is called Willard Park. It is just adjacent, south of Woodruff Place, and then just east of the Cottage Home neighborhood.
So about how far is that from downtown?
About a mile east of the Circle.
Okay, and what drew you there?
Well, it was in proximity to downtown. I wanted to be near campus. However, having a family, it's very expensive to live in something large enough for, you know, a husband, wife, and three children, very, very close to campus. So basically that's about as close as we could afford to live.
So what was it like when you moved there?
Quiet. We moved from the countryside between Mooresville, Martinsville, Monrovia. So, you know, pristine southern hills of Indiana. And we were constantly being woken up by large trucks and gunshots and dogs and, you know, the lifestyle of relatively close density living in the country. And it's something that really surprised us when we first moved into this neighborhood, just how quiet the street was. We knew we were so close to downtown, so close to our jobs and to school, and yet it was quiet.
So why do you think that it was like that, considering that a lot of the other neighborhoods aren't.
Our little nook of our neighborhood is either young families like us or empty houses. And yes, vacant houses cause problems and draw issues, obviously. But I think that there's enough life in the neighborhood, quality life, and people that people watch out, and there's a lot of neighbors looking out after neighbors. We also are adjacent to the reentry facility. So
could you explain that, what that
yeah,
is?
Yeah, yeah. It's part of the, you know, the Department of Corrections, but it's a large reentry facility where inmates go, you know, during like their last stints of their sentence, I guess. I'm not sure like what kinds of backgrounds go to this facility, but they are working toward getting back into society. Our neighborhood actually utilizes their help in a lot of neighborhood projects, neighborhood cleanups, building of community gardens. There's a neighborhood connecting person, I don't know what their title is, in the facility. And we can reach out to this person and they'll put together a group of men to come and help do projects in the neighborhood. So they really are a pretty awesome asset to the neighborhood. And I think it helps keep crime down and keep things quiet.
So. That's unexpected.
It is.
Did you know about that before you moved in?
Well, yes, because it's right across the street, so we saw it. I didn't know about it until we went to look at the rental property, and I'll be honest, I almost didn't get out of the car. Nope, we're not renting this one. There's that prison across the street. But we got out and talked to the landlord, got to hear a little bit about the neighborhood and the neighbors, and we actually ended up meeting a couple neighbors walking around afterward, after that first initial meeting. We're like, you know, I think this might be a good place to be for a while.
So what was it that definitely changed your mind?
Knowing that we had, that there was a community there already. There were neighbors with children who looked after each other that got together and played horseshoes in the field in the alley. That too, there's a large field right behind the property. So our kids had a place to play. There were three parks in walking distance for them to play at. So
So when you moved into your neighborhood around November 2013, mm-hmm. did you consider yourself an environmental advocate at that point?
Absolutely. I probably have been since I could talk or think about it.
So what caused that in you?
You know, I often wonder, because it's been such a part of my ethics from as far back as I can remember. In the little neighborhood I grew up with my parents there at the north side, there was like, I thought it was a forest behind our house. It's really like a grove of trees, but some open space, no houses, no buildings, some quiet open space. And I spent most of my childhood back in the forest, as I called it. It's the woods, I thought. Most of my summer, my week, I spent all my time there, or at least in the backyard, and I would just sit, and I would look at nature, and I would contemplate nature. That's what I did as a kid. So it was a very big part of what was important to me early on in life.
So with such a unique mm-hmm. viewpoint from when you were a child, what sorts of things have you become involved in for environmental advocacy in your adulthood?
My environmental science degree. So when I graduated high school, I actually went to Heron School of Art first. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I really enjoyed photography and art in general, and that's what I did for a couple semesters, and all of my art was very nature focused. But from the early age of sitting and contemplating nature to the older age of learning to be the artist and involve nature in art, I just kept wanting to know more. And the way that I wanted, that I thought would help me learn more about how the natural environment works and operates and what is my part in this, was science. There's different avenues to connecting with nature, and I think most of them are valid. but this was one I wanted to explore. So it's one thing to read things on the internet that may or may not be true, to have a personal opinion or love of something, to have your own personal ethics and try and pull your family and friends into wanting to help and treasure this precious thing we call nature. It's another thing to be able to come with some science, with some facts that we can, you know, really sink your teeth into, I guess. It felt to me it'd be a foundation to help me talk to the people in my life.
So since you've moved downtown and since you have such a unique view of the environment around you, how do you think that changes how you view downtown and living downtown?
So I never thought I would live downtown. First and foremost, I like trees, I like plants and animals and to be amongst nature. And it was definitely something, the move downtown was something that we decided on as a very temporary move. Year and a half tops. We're there and, well, you know, we probably have a few more years here. I've ended up loving the lifestyle of being downtown because of the convenience factor. We bike everywhere. We have kid carts we trail behind us and haul our kids around. And in the back of my mind, every time I get behind the wheel of a vehicle and I'm burning fossil fuels, there's like this tiny bit of guilt. It's the way we function. It's how our system works. We have to, you know, turn our stoves on and turn our lights on and drive vehicles sometimes. But being able to incorporate bike riding in our life was something it's something we won't give up. You know, however life takes us, wherever it ends up taking us, like, we won't give that up in life. But so as far as how I view nature and living downtown, I think when I ride by trees and little grassy nooks and crannies, I really appreciate each and every one. Each and every little spot that isn't the built environment. I know on a larger scale, like an ecosystem scale, it's not like there's a bunch of wonderful, healthy examples to come look at in Indianapolis, but I don't know. I think I lost my train of thought there.
That's okay. So speaking of healthy and environment, you have three kids at home, three young kids.
Yes.
And so moving downtown and knowing the pollution levels and that sort of thing, how has that affected what you do for your kids, especially in your own environment area?
Well, as far as air pollution goes, there's not a whole lot to immediately do about it. Goodness knows if anyone like had developed a case of asthma, we'd been out fast, you know. We still spend plenty of time in parks and areas with trees, so you go to Garfield Park, it smells different. You can tell you're breathing different air. Soil pollution is a very big issue. That's probably at least as big a factor affecting children as air pollution in Indianapolis. It's the lead contamination in our soil. Kids play on the ground, they roll around in the soil, they dig in the soil. My son loves to dig. I didn't know about the lead soil problem when we moved downtown. I didn't know about that yet. I know a lot about it now. So very quickly I had our yard tested here at IUPUI, actually in Gabe Filippelli's lab. And I took samples from several different locations around our yard and know where the hot spots are, if you will, know where the kids don't need to be, which is basically along the perimeter of the house. So in the little, you know, 3 foot side yard, which isn't really a place to play anyway. But our backyard is safe, so that was good to know.
So what made you aware of the lead in the soil?
I'm trying to remember where I first heard. You know, I think I went to a Earth Science Department conference in
Gabe gave a brief presentation about the work that he and his grad students have done in Indianapolis. I think that's the first place I learned about it. I know that that's the first place that I really got a deep understanding of just what the problem was. So he has generated all these amazing maps of the lead contamination downtown, and you can see the plume in the soil that kind of follows the weather pattern due to the Harding Street coal-fired power plant. So the way our weather patterns move and carry that the emissions across the landscape, there's actually like a concentrated plume around the center of Indy. So
can you tell me who Gabe is?
I'm sorry, Gabe Filippelli is a professor in the Earth Science Department. He's actually on leave this year, I think working in D.C. Right. I don't know what his precise role is, associate professor.
That's good.
Okay, I know that he works with the with SPIA, or the public health department, rather. Here at IUPUI. And his field that he's sort of pioneering is called medical geology. So he's a geologist by trade. I know he's done a lot of research with climate as well as soil. But then, you know, what is this linkage to people? So, medical geology.
So a person who's actually listening to our interview later might reasonably conclude that the direct threat to your children from the local environment contamination may have moved you to become more involved locally as an advocate. Do you find that reasonable? Do you
see
that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wish I could say that I've gone to all of these Beyond Coal campaigns. I read about them. I stay informed about them. I wish I could say I was more involved in these sorts of groups. We read and talk about things. I'm busy.
But to give credit where credit's due, you do talk to your neighbors and that sort of thing you mentioned in your pre-interview. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was getting my soil tested, it was very early in the spring, or maybe not even quite spring yet. And then, you know, not long after that, people are talking about gardens every spring. And they're going to the health department to get their soils tested. And, you know, some properties were coming with crazy high levels, some were not so bad. And basically I was able to come and inform them about, you know, where in your yard you need to be aware of. So I still don't know how the Marion County Health Department goes about testing properties. I don't know what their method is. I know what we do if we send soil to the lab here at IUPUI. I know that method, and that is to collect five different samples, and then but from particular locations, so definitely from the perimeter of any structure and then near the roadside. So the perimeter of structures often contain high levels of lead due to the lead-based paint that was used for years and years. And so when that chips off the house, or it's, you know, manually chipped off the house for a new coat of paint, that accumulates in the soil. And then up by the roads, because of the lead in the gasoline for decades and decades, those emissions have settled down into the soil near the roadways, and so you have higher concentrations there. So when people were particularly concerned, or maybe didn't want to get their soil tested, or, you know, it's just like, well, here's a good rule of thumb, if you will. You know, mulch the roof, or the perimeter of your house. Don't mulch the roof of your house, that would be bad. A lot of water and destroy things. Mulch the perimeter of your house. Don't dig in it. Keep plants there. Keep the soil down. You're not going to get rid of the lead in the soil. It's there. It binds to the soil particles. It doesn't really leach down into the groundwater. It's rarely uptaken by plants. There are certain plants that are metal accumulators, and under acidic conditions, it can be mobilized and move into the plants, but basically your produce is fine. The problem is when you're actually doing the gardening work or playing in your yard, you're stirring up the dust particles, and then the lead exposure comes from inhalation. So these are all things I was able to talk to my neighbors about. Some of them had an inkling of the issue. Most of them thought that the real issue was, oh, I don't want to grow tomatoes because then my tomatoes will be full of lead. It's like, no, your tomatoes are fine. It's your actual act of gardening. And then, so there were a couple stubborn neighbors, if you will. And, you know, the best way I could put it to them was like, well, even if you're not worried about your brain development at 40 some years of age, you're still mobilizing this contaminant into the air. And, you know, my kids and their kids, they're playing right next door. So you're exposing them to lead when you till your soil, when you dig into it. So those kinds of things.
So you're employed by CEASE as an education outreach coordinator.
Yes.
Just for those listening, according to CEASE's website, its mission is to provide applied interdisciplinary environmental solutions to translate research into action while promoting environmental stewardship through education and public service programs.
Okay, it's kind of the overall objective of CEASE as a center. Yeah.
Right. So within the parameters of that mission, can you kind of explain what you do as for your job as outreach or education outreach coordinator?
Absolutely. So we work with different entities, schools during the school year. During the summer, we seek out camps and other summer programming to come deliver science programming. So most of our traditional programming is environment-based, and the idea is that we're using the natural environment as a vehicle to teach kids science concepts. And then, yes, there is a part of teaching science to kids in which stewardship should come with it, I think. I think there's probably a lot of debate about that in the scientific community, but I think stewardship is a part of science, absolutely. So I lost my train of thought again. So we bring technology and we put technology in the kids' hands. We teach them how to properly use scientific equipment, how to use the lab quests and the iPads as a scientific device, not a toy to take selfies on. and they do investigations. So typically we'll start out with an introductory activity or two, maybe a game, a science game, or we have activities online on our website that they'll do in our technology trailer. We have a 20-foot mobile technology trailer that has four computers in it that are actually, their monitors are like, I don't know size of television screens, but large flat screen televisions with touch screen pads that mirror them. So they have this kind of large experience of a screen and do different activities, usually involving Google Earth, so that they can kind of get a global perspective of an issue, perhaps, like in our sustainable energy program, or to enhance their mapping skills. So they'll do introductory activities like that first. And then they have guided worksheets that are, once again, online that they'll use the iPads for. And these guided worksheets will give background information on the different things they're investigating. And then some of them will also like have little reminders and instructions on how to use the equipment, because that's pretty important. Get lots and lots of kids using equipment over and over again. It's a big thing we hit home on, is how to properly use equipment. So they'll have the lab quest and then their, you know, the other scientific tools to take measurements, and then they record in their iPads. And then at the end of the investigation, they should have the data and the knowledge to make a conclusion about the program. Whether it's an ecosystem investigation, water quality investigation, they're able to make some kind of general assessment. This isn't like publishable scientific work, but, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how healthy or how biodiverse is this ecosystem? That kind of conclusion.
So what kind, can you give some mm-hmm. examples of what environmental tools and what kind of conclusions and that sort of thing
you can do? Yeah, absolutely. So in The tool that we use the most is, they're called LabQuest. They're a little handheld device. And then they come, well, they offer, I think, like 50 different sensors and probes that you can buy to, that connect to them. And so we have maybe a dozen of these different probes. You know, there's a temperature sensor, there's soil moisture, there's several different water quality probes, dissolved oxygen, we have a flow meter, and all of these different things hook to this LabQuest. And the LabQuest, you can use as to get an instantaneous reading, you can graph over time, and we use those different functions for different programs. And so once they have learned this little bit of background information, okay, so let's see, a stream should have these different environments within it for flora and fauna to thrive. So, you know, we want to look for unsediment bottoms, you know, gravel and boulders, not full of silt. We actually have a program where they go and collect the macroinvertebrates and do the index for that as well. And so, you know, by the end of these water quality programs, they'll be able to determine, okay, well, here is, you know, physically here is a healthy stream. It's meandering. It has multiple different microenvironments in it. Or no, it's channelized. It's eroding very quickly. You know, the landscape's changed. This isn't a healthy stream anymore. So
when you became the education outreach coordinator, what sorts of things did you change with the program?
Let's see here. So when I first came into the program, I was a part-time intern, and I think we were making changes even then. So even before I was really put in charge of things, we were adapting. So that's kind of the traditional way that our Discovering the Science of the Environment worked. We have these programs that all center around the technology and the trailer and an environmental investigation. When I first really got rolling, we were trying to figure out how we can bring this to more of the urban population. So previously the program went to a lot of suburban and township schools and really wasn't hitting IPS at all, and then other high need environments. So we really wanted to figure out how we can do this kind of inquiry based programming that is supposed to be, you know, the investigation itself is supposed to be self-led in these more challenging environments. And by the time things got rolling, it was getting into the off season. So being an outdoor program, the trailer and all that would happen typically just a few months in the fall and a few months in the spring. So this is coming into like October, November. And we started in IPS 69. So our community partner, Esther Bekele, she runs the Falege Hiawatha Center in the Martindale Brightwood neighborhood. And she has done amazing, amazing work with the youth in that area for, well, decades, I think. And so she had already had these established relationships in IPS and these handful of schools. And so IPS 69 is the first one that we really went into to work. And they had a room set aside as a dedicated science lab. And Esther and I and a couple of the undergraduate interns would go weekly, we would go to the school 3 to 4 days a week, and we would meet with the classes weekly. So they came to us kind of like another specials time. And that environment, we really were just hitting home some basic science programming, basic programs that would teach the basic standards in the curriculum. Because most of these kids hadn't had science maybe ever in their life, in their school career, or personal life for that matter. So we were working with 3rd through 6th graders. And I mean, even the 6th graders most of them had never had any science at all. So that was a very interesting experience. And that role, we were really just trying to see how we could be a positive influence in these kids' education. We went in there with the idea of some environmental aspects, and it really broke down quickly because that foundation just wasn't naturally there for most of these kids. Didn't have this innate connection with the natural environment, and it wasn't a vehicle for learning science anymore. It was a barrier. So I pretty much left that behind kind of quickly, and through the cold winter months, we did fun hands-on activities in the classroom. So anyway, now that we're at this point, so we've been at a STAIRS camp all summer at Philega High Watt, and it's been actually some of the same kids from IPS 69, and then we were also working IPS 51 by springtime. It's been a handful of the same kids at the camp, but it's definitely the same community and the same culture that we're working with. And being summer, being at a camp environment, an urban farm, we have been able to start making some of these environmental connections as well. And I really feel like we're posed to maybe go back into these schools this coming school year and hopefully bring the environmental side to the science programming again.
So with the lack of the education in science the kids are getting, why do you think it's so important that they get the basic understanding of science if they're already not being taught in the schools necessarily?
So there's kind of two threads of argument, if you will, in what we do. Funders and, well, there's two basic threads. One being when you can give more science to kids, when you can bring these special programs, you can pique their interest, then you're going to be hopefully increasing the numbers in the STEM workforce. Not to use science and STEM interchangeably, but that's kind of the focus right now is STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. So that is a noble goal, but the other thread and the other avenue of thought is we're helping to create a more science, STEM and science savvy culture, community. We as a nation kind of fall behind in math and science, globally speaking, and we need to have an informed people that can make rational decisions about what they're being told. My favorite example currently is, okay, the media is full of all kinds of crazy stuff about climate change. They even still call it global warming, which is only kind of accurate. And the fact that there is this public debate even happening is really sad. I mean, there is enough scientific evidence to show that, yes, this is conclusively happening. Yes, we know it's a human cause. We know what the problem is. Now we need to be thinking about fixing it, not still back 30 years ago debating this. We're not moving forward. We're not helping to change anything in a positive direction. So when you're able to get a child interested in something early enough in life, that they have a chance to really grow and deepen their knowledge in it before they become an adult, then, you know, they're able to take that with them through life and be an informed person. So, yeah, I guess that's it.
Okay, so we're going to shift gears just a little bit.
Yes, that's fine.
Since Charter School is a Southeast Neighborhood School for Excellence, and my understanding is that both of your daughters will be attending class there this next year, what drew you to Sense?
Well, actually, so my eldest son is a boy, and then our second is Adela. So that I have a first grader and kindergartner there right now.
Okay.
And then Nadia will go in a couple years. Assuming we're still here, which I think we will be. Anyway, what drew us to Sense? We actually had never heard of Sense. One of our neighbors down the road, they were integral in helping us get settled in. We met this family I think the first week we moved in the house, we went to take a walk, and there was Sarah, and she had her three little kids who were all within a couple months of our kids in age. So they're like, oh, you're another crazy person too. Three kids in 3 years. so that was really awesome. And so we talked She helped us in understanding like what we needed to do to get Dylan enrolled in kindergarten. So when we had just moved in, this is like the middle of November, and you know, my little boy had turned 5 in September. I wasn't ready to think about kindergarten yet. And she's like, oh, but if you want him in a magnet program, you got to have this done by December 15th or whatever. And it was just like this huge, oh my gosh, my kid's going to school. So Sarah was integral in helping us kind of walk through that process. So we kind of looked at magnet schools together. And so Dylan was on, like enrolled in IPS and on a list for a couple different magnet schools. And then she came to us one day and was like, you know, we found this really awesome school in Fountain Square. We think Elena's going to go there. Should check it out. So we trust her opinion. We went to check it out and met Kate Voss. So pretty much enough said. Kate Voss is just so open and welcoming, so community focused. She is an individual, but then, yeah, the sense ethos is, you know, we are a community school. We are here to serve our neighborhood families, our school families. And I really think that's important. That's something that a school used to always be in neighborhoods, was this community center. And many schools, even outside of the urban area, are totally lacking that kind of cohesive relationship with their families, and I really appreciated that about Sense. And then they also do a lot with the Fountain Square community and really into the arts and the art scene that's happening there, and that's a lot of fun. They also incorporate science across the curriculum and across all the grade levels. So I'm like, okay, it's like a good school. We'll try this out.
So you became involved with Sense in November of 2013.
Well, I don't know when we actually went for that school visit. It probably would have been more like the following spring.
Okay, so that 2013 year-ish.
Yeah.
But this past summer, you ran a camp called the Eco Science Camp for a week at Sense. Yeah. How did you become professionally involved with Sense?
So in my role as education outreach coordinator, I'm able to make relationships with different programs that, you know, different entities that we can bring our programming to. And of course, yes, there's some selfish here. Like, this is my children's school. We have some awesome programming. Maybe we can fit this into our schedule. And so we actually, I talked with Kate about this on and off the whole fall that Dylan was in kindergarten, so last fall, which would be 2013. Oh, geez. Maybe I moved to the house in 2012. Okay, dates are rough. It's okay. Anyway, so the Dylan's first fall in kindergarten, Kate and I talked about what we could do to bring some programming there. And so at the start of the spring semester, she's like, you know, last year I ran this 4-H camp. Do you think you'd be interested in bringing programming to that? It's like, yeah, we could do that, because our program was already looking into starting after-school clubs or working with after-school clubs. We don't actually run the programs. We bring programming to the programs. Anyway, so we did an after-school club all spring. We kind of called it STEM in the Garden. So we were using the school's garden environment as the natural environment, and then teaching kids science through gardening. A lot of soil testing, water-related programs. I think we talked about luminosity and solar radiation, and you know, whatever we could throw in. So Kate and I did that all spring, and I had in my head last summer of this idea of bringing programming to these summer servings locations. So they're all around Indy. The USDA has the Summer Servings Program, where any child, anyone under 18 years of age, can eat breakfast and lunch for free. Well, some of the sites just do lunch. Some do breakfast and lunch. And like, you know, why don't we bring programming here? The kids are already gathering. You know, we can give them an hour of something more to do in their summer. And when I learned that Sense was a summer servings location, I said, well, hey, this will be perfect. And so we tossed around ideas of, you know, once a week or what we can do. And with our schedule and the turnout for the lunch, we figured that a one-week camp would be best. I'm like, okay, Pleasant Run's right next door. Kate and I are always talking about what we can do to help get these kids to understand why they should be playing in the water, how we can get them to become little citizen advocates about the water quality, about their environment. So I'm like, okay, let's have a stream ecosystem camp. And so we did. It was a week long. It was geared toward fifth grade and up. And I think we ended up getting only that age group, basically. So it worked out pretty well.
So what sorts of things did you teach them during camp?
So we started out with some water cycle activities first. Kind of get them thinking about how water affects their everyday life. I think everyone knows by a very young age that you don't survive without water, that all living things need water. Sure, but how do you really use it in your everyday life? And then how are you connected to this larger picture of the water cycle? So we did that for the first day. The second day of camp, we did a riparian ecosystem investigation. So riparian ecosystem is the ecosystem along the stream corridor, so the land on either side of the stream. And so they did like a biodiversity assessment, how healthy is the ecosystem surrounding the stream. That was a rough day. It kind of worked, but trying to teach them that, okay, so we've had this larger picture of the water cycle. Now, here is the environment right next to your stream. How does the quality of that environment directly affect the stream itself? And then we moved into the stream basically the last 3 days. We did a physical assessment, a chemical assessment, and then the biological assessment, which are the kind of the three overarching parameters that all work together to determine, you know, a stream ecosystem.
So that last day, what the kind of things did the kids find when they tested?
On the last day, we did the biological assessment, which is, for me, the most fun. It's when you collect benthic macroinvertebrates and do the PTI index. And they found a lot of crayfish, crawdads. A lot. Which is actually pretty good. They're semi-intolerant to pollution, so that was good. We didn't find a whole lot of macroinvertebrates, but by the last day, there were only a couple of older boys that came, and they were really just interested in, you know, hunting for mud puppies. But anyway.
So according to you, and from what Kate said earlier, a lot of the kids play in the creek and dig around in the mud in the surrounding area.
Yeah.
What kinds of things did you teach them about that?
First and foremost, along Pleasant Run in different areas and other streams around the city, there are big red warning signs that say, warning, don't touch this water, don't get in this water, there's sewage pollution in this water. And showing them that is actually one of the most effective ways to teach them to not get in it, I think. They're all very grossed out by this idea of combined sewage overflow. So we would teach them about that issue. So Indianapolis, our wastewater treatment plants aren't equipped to handle all of the storm water that surges in during a rain event. Some of our storm drains flow straight to the stream. Some of them flow to the wastewater treatment plants for treatment first. If it rains more than like a quarter inch in Indianapolis, the wastewater treatment plants can't handle that influx, and they have to basically like open the floodgates and let some of the raw untreated sewage into the streams. That's obviously an immediate health threat if you are to get in that water. E. coli, enough said, that's pretty bad. So, I mean, that gross out factor and that immediate idea of feces in your water, like, that's a pretty good way to keep kids out of the water. Unfortunately, that's not like the worst, though. The industrial contaminants is kind of a loftier concept that's hard for them to really understand because you don't see it. And that's, those are the kind of contaminants that can do damage over the long run. And it's again with kids, that idea of the long run is, you know, that concept isn't really understood yet. Life is forever when you're 8 or 10, so.
So the benefit of those who will listen later, the Indianapolis coke plant is a heavy industrial site that once produced fuel with few impurities and high carbon content, usually made from coal. It has been the center of a lot of pollution controversy, and the plant is actually located just farther down on Pleasant Run. So what makes the coke plant pollutants potentially more dangerous than the waste ones?
I mean, E. coli is dangerous, sure. And not to say that there aren't other chemicals and industrial contaminants in the water that's coming from the sewage treatment plant, too. But what's coming from that facility, once again, I should do some better research on exactly what's coming, but it's bad. They're contaminants that will accumulate and stay in your body and continue to do damage over time. So... oh gosh, we went through this the other day. I know mercury, arsenic, lots of heavy metals, which are going to cause a lot of the same problems as lead. PCBs, right? I know we talked about that before as well. And even just being in the water, you don't have to drink this to be content, you know, to have contamination into your body. Our skin is porous. Regularly have, you know, minor cuts and scrapes and things, especially kids. You're exposing yourself to this. You're exposing your organs and you did some really bad long-term damage.
Could you explain what a PBC is for those who listen later and don't know?
No, I'm sorry. It's been too long since my environmental health classes.
You told me during your pre-interview it was a pollutant that's fat soluble.
Yes, it is fat soluble. It does. So what that means is when it gets inside of an organism, it stays there. It's stored in fat tissues. So this is especially an issue when eating fish. The smaller fish will ingest this, and then as the larger fish ingest them, and, you know, the larger fish are ingesting multiple smaller fish, so the larger fish are accumulating more and more of this in their bodies as you move up the aquatic food chain. So it's biomagnification is the fancy word for that. So anyone who's to, you know, throw a fishing rod in these waters and eat the fish are putting a whole lot of the contaminant into their system at that point. PVC, poly, I don't remember. Polybiphenyl chloride. I don't know. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's horrible.
So at the federal level, Congress passed the Federal Water Pollution Control Act amendments of 1972. And later approved more amendments in 1977 and 87. And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency oversees enforcement of federal water pollution control legislation. So in 72, nationally and locally, a Clean Water Act was passed, and the act was meant to have, and I'm now quoting the Environmental Protection Agency, a national goal of swimmable and fishable waterways, end quote. So do you think that overall Indiana has made progress in making its waterways swimmable and fishable?
Yeah, absolutely. The nation as a whole has made large progress since 1972. However, we haven't met that goal. That was a long time ago. So that's pretty frustrating.
So how do you think people should be moving toward that goal? What are some of the things that should or could be happening to meet?
As individuals, yes, we do cause pollution. So yeah, we don't need to be throwing our paint thinner down into the sewers. I think most people know that by now, right? Or you know, your used oil, whatever people used to throw down their their sewer drains all the time. I don't know. So as individuals, there are actions you can take. Absolutely. And collectively, if everyone takes clean actions, that makes a huge difference. It does. And that kind of public education, I think, has done a lot to help with the public, like, you know, household pollution issues into the water. However, industry still pollutes a lot, and it's our larger systems that are keeping our water from being swimmable and fishable, not individuals, you know, dumping one thing in the water. It's a larger scale issue. So, you know, EPA passes legislation regularly enough trying to clean things up and trying to regulate industry. And that word regulate, I think, goes through people. Well, it's the, you know, big brother telling me what to do. It's government telling me how to live, how to operate my business. And corporations are individuals with rights too, I guess, and they don't want to be told what to do. And where, you know, our American ideals of freedom and independence are absolutely valid and important. You wanting to do whatever the heck you want to do at the expense of everyone else's well-being is not an American ideal to me. So it takes education. And I think if we have a more educated body of just people who know these things, then maybe the pressure can be put to the corporations and the industry to clean up.
So to close out our time, environmental justice is becoming quite the hot topic in Indianapolis. Could you kind of explain in your own words what you think environmental justice is?
To me, that means that everyone has the right to a healthy environment, to be able to go about their daily life where they live in their community in a healthy manner, so that everyone has access to a clean waterway, to clean soil, to clean air. I mean, this is what our bodies come in contact with daily. This is what we swim in, what we breathe. We aren't very separate from our environment. And every individual has the right to that, regardless of their socioeconomic status. And yes, over and over again, our poor neighborhoods are situated near the larger industries that do the polluting. I mean, it's kind of a global issue. I was going to say national, but I think that's pretty much everywhere. Our corporations are supposed to be good neighbors too. So
yeah. Can you paint a little bit of a picture of what it looks like in Indianapolis?
Indianapolis is, to me, it's very patchworky. So when I was a kid, early 90s, I mean, Indy wasn't a place that people went to for fun from outside of the city. You came near the city to the airport to go on vacation. You came downtown for, like, football and basketball games. I don't think there was any other reason to go downtown. Indianapolis has come a long way to be a vibrant city. But it's very patchworky. There's neighborhoods that have come a long way right next to neighborhoods that haven't been revitalized yet. But I think some of the neighborhoods that are still in some of the hardest hit areas, if you will, are next to these big industries. I mean, you have the coal-fired power plant on Harding Street, and that, I mean, the whole south side over there, it's all really run down. It's all pretty impoverished. Some of the poorest neighborhoods in our city are right next to Eli Lilly. I don't know that particular building is putting out tons of pollution. I don't know exactly what, I mean, it's more research and business oriented, but nonetheless, you know, here's somebody who could be doing, and yes, Lily does do a lot around our city. Oh my goodness. Yes, they do. They send their employees out on, you know, the Lily Days of Service, and that's awesome. I think a corporation that large could probably be doing a lot more for the people who live right next door and look at their building every day.
What sorts of things do you think, not only Eli mm-hmm. Lilly and Company, but all the corporations, what could they right. be doing to help the situation be?
So, you don't just hand people money, obviously. That's not some solution. But, you know, go fix up someone's house who don't have the means to do that. Create some education outreach programs. You could afford that. You could throw some money at creating your own or helping those that you already fund in even larger ways. And then, you know, those that are spewing tons of pollution into our environment, well, maybe look into the technology and research that's going to help you not do that anymore. Find cleaner ways to operate.
So not only as an environmental advocate, but also as an education outreach coordinator professionally, what do you hope for most when you educate young children who will be the next generation?
I hope that they have an appreciation of the natural environment that is more than just knowing that it's a life support system. That's kind of first and foremost, is to even just get them to understand that it's their life support system. That we are a part of this, not apart from this thing we call nature, and that everything that keeps you alive is derived from these, from nature. And hope that they have this larger appreciation for that.
Okay, so finally, mm-hmm. is there anything you wish I had asked but I hadn't?
No.
That's fine.
Okay.
Is there anything you wish you could have said during the interview but didn't get the chance?
Maybe this. Okay, so I did live in a rural environment, and I live in an urban environment, and it, as a mother, it was more comforting to let my kids go and romp and stomp and be amongst nature in the country. I have to put some blocking up in my brain sometimes when we go to parks and things and play, because I'm not going to not let them know that feeling. But there is definitely concern. What's in the soil? No, you can't go barefoot. No, you can't get in the water. No, you can't creek stomp. And that's really sad to me.
All right, well, thank you for participating in the interview and your help with the Waterways Project. We appreciate it.